As those of you who've been here know, before earlier in the year know, I gave out sheets with all the 10 trials of Abraham. And I was going to go over the trials today, but it's okay actually that I forgot the sheets. They're upstairs. I mean, I could always get them, but I'm going to try to make a virtue of necessity and talk a little bit about what we did this year to prepare us for the summer and next year. And also, I brought two books by our guest this weekend. And I'm going to say a little bit about his approach to Bible, because both of these books have biblical portraits by Elie Wiesel. Those of you, he's speaking first of all tonight, tomorrow night at 7:30 for Friday Night Live. Everybody is invited to the Friday Night Live. Then I'm going to have the younger people go to a question and answer with him in a separate room after the service. He'll be speaking Shabbos morning when the sermon is normally given, which is sometime after. If you get there by 8:45, you won't miss it. So it's usually around 11, a little after. Oops. Not only that, but if you get there by 8:45, you'll find a parking space. Later than that, and then he's speaking Sunday with the teenagers who are asking questions. The ones who won the essay contest will be announced that morning. They'll come up on stage and they'll each ask Elie Wiesel their question. I think there are 12, and that will be at 10 o'clock. So Friday night, 7:30, Saturday during services, and then Sunday at 10 o'clock. Yes, I guess so. But what's that? He's going to be answering questions from the teenagers on Sunday. On Sunday, yeah. I'm assuming the tickets are available at the door. I don't know. I didn't hear what you said, Miriam. What? What I'm going to say on Friday night is it's for Atid, which is ages 20 to 40. I'm not going to block anyone at the door, but I hope that people who are older will give that age group their one chance to spend time with him. So if people don't, they don't, but I hope they will. Sephardic Temple. Yes. What is it? That Amos Oz, who is at Sephardic Temple, he was here, right. He was here 3 years ago. Was it 3 years ago he was here, and he was wonderful? Yes. So anyway. All right. Any other questions about Wiesel's appearance? And if not, let's spend a little bit of time wrapping this up. Okay, so the two books that I brought, he's written about 40 books altogether, something like that, 20 to, or 30 books, rather. The two that I brought are called Sages and Dreamers and Messengers of God. Sages and Dreamers has portraits from the Bible, the Talmud, and the Hasidic tradition, all of them. One of them, by the way, relevant to our studies so far, is a portrait of Noah. And I'll give you a sense of how he, I'm going to read one or two sections from Messengers of God, but this is how he begins his description of Noah. And all of these are based on regular lectures that he's been giving over the years at the 92nd Street Y. Right? And since he is very, very, very well versed in Talmud and Hasidic tradition as well, he speaks not only about the Bible, but also about the Talmud and Hasidic masters. This is how he begins with Noah. Let us begin at the end. I mean, at what could have been the end. Not of a story, but of history itself. For if ever the apocalypse seemed irrevocable, if ever the universe came close to being silenced, it was then, right at the beginning. It was as though God were choosing to tell a strange tale, a tale in which the epilogue and the prologue almost touched, leaving nothing in between. That's the beginning of his description of Noah. And here is a typical passage in which he brings both the Bible and his own experience together. As I reread the story of Noah and his children, I see myself as a child in Cheder. Cheder was the children's religious school that Eastern European Jews went to, which Wiesel did. He had a very traditional Hasidic background. Leaning over a tattered Bible, under the watchful eye of the teacher, I see myself in the world before the other deluge, the one my generation had to endure. So he was waiting for that deluge means a flood. He was waiting for the flood of the Shoah, just as just as Noah did. And then he says, and Noah obeys. He follows the divine instructions to the letter. Whatever God wants him to do and say, he says and does. Faithful to his mission, he fulfills it to the end. Thanks to him, mankind will survive. It will survive through him. The world will drown, but Noah will have saved it nevertheless. The floods will come and go, and thanks to Noah, mankind will begin again to work, to hope, to sin, to repent, and that's the subject of my story. It reads like a play. We watch Noah make his preparations, witness his drama, his tragedy, and we see the consequences and the fallout. Step by step, we follow the events from beginning to end. In fact, we follow Noah right into his ark. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here to tell the tale. So he writes very wonderfully and beautifully about everything, but about biblical characters. And he has, in here, he has two sections that are relevant to what we've done so far. One is about Adam, and one is about Cain and Abel. He goes on with the sacrifice of Isaac, but we haven't gotten to that yet. So Boy, there's a lot of stuff in here worth reading, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to read one or two quick sections. Okay. Here's a great one from the Talmud that he quotes. A king met Rabban Gamliel and told him, frequently in the Talmud, kings or philosophers will have dialogues with rabbis and they'll ask questions, and of course the rabbis always have a good answer. A king met Rabban Gamliel and told him, I don't know how to say this, but your God, yes, your God is nothing but a thief. Here was Adam sleeping the sleep of the just, and suddenly God steals one of his ribs. But here's the best part. Rabban Gamliel's daughter chose to answer the sovereign. Notice she beats her father to the punch. Do you know what happened to me last night, Your Majesty? She said. Thieves entered my house. They took all my silver, and in place they left gold. If only I could be the victim of such robbers every night, said the king. Well, said the sage's daughter, that's precisely what happened to Adam. It's true, Adam took a rib from him, but in exchange he gave him a beautiful woman who helped him when he needed help, served him when he needed to be served, and was silent when he talked. So there you go, right, exactly. Can't add anything to that. Okay. All right, let me read two paragraphs from Adam, and then we'll move on to, well, maybe a quick thing from Cain and Abel, and then a couple words on Abraham, and then we'll go off to work to our day. The name of this book is Messengers of God. The Bible tells us that the couple was chased from paradise, the rest we know. The Midrash, with lavish use of imagery, goes on to describe the events and their consequences in great detail. At first, these were merely physical. Adam's body grew smaller and smaller. Then they became spiritual as well. He lost his powers over the animals. He no longer radiated light. Worse, for the first time, he discovered the meaning of anguish and fear. Whereas before, he stood proudly erect when he listened to God, now he tried to escape God's voice. Where are you? God asked him. As the celebrated Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi said, what? God didn't know where Adam was hiding? No, this is a question God asks of every man, always. Where are you? What's your place in the world? What are you doing with your life? Still, the Midrash believes that Adam, shamed by his sin, was actually trying to hide, and God had to admonish him. Tell me, man, who are you hiding? Do you really believe the house can hide from its builder? Adam was no longer the same. Now imagine what happens when when Adam eats the apple and all the world crashes in on him. He saw death everywhere. Objects, images, feelings, words, impulses. Everything revolved around his obsession with death. The sun went down, a sign that my end is near. I'll lose consciousness in the dark. The sun is rising, surely it will burn me. A stranger to the world and to himself, he no longer knew where to look, what signs to watch for. Who were his enemies? Where were they lying in wait for him? Everywhere and within himself. He was afraid to make a move, to utter a word. Unknown forces beset and chained him down. He was convinced it was written all over him. The beasts and the animals he had once tamed now looked at him in a different way, with hate. As soon as they saw him, they fell silent. And when he listened to his own heart, he found it empty of joy and desire. Fear, black and biting fear, was his only companion. Expelled from paradise, he entered time. So if you don't come hear him, you're foolish. That's all I have to say. part of what you can feel it behind Wiesel's writing is even when he's writing about something else, it's informed by his experience of his life. You know, that description of seeing fear all around you because you lose paradise as a child is exactly the experience of his life. So, there's a lot more to say. I talked about him yesterday at the Lunch and Learn, at the Lunch and Learn, at much greater length. But let me actually just tie together that and what we're doing here, and we'll be able to talk more about it when we resume next semester, so to speak, with the Akedah. Because the Akedah is in some ways the paradigm story for Jews who suffer throughout Jewish history. Not just for the biblical story of Abraham asked to sacrifice his child, but also through the Middle Ages. There's a book by a scholar named Shalom Spiegel called The Last Trial. And it's called The Last Trial because, as I said, Abraham's life, which we'll take a look at next time, was built on 10 trials. And what the 10 trials were is debated, but they're essentially that he had to leave his home and he had to face famine and he had to deal with Hagar and Sarah and he had to fight the war with the kings and he had to divide his property with Lavan and all of the things that we read about, had to kick Ishmael out of the house. And then finally, after Isaac is born, he has to carry Isaac up to the mountain, right, and sacrifice him. And the reason that Spiegel called his book The Last Trial is, first of all, according to the rabbinic tradition, the Akedah is the last trial. And what his book is an annotated poem. And annotated means he made notes on a poem that was written in the Middle Ages during the Crusades by a man who essentially said Abraham had it good because he didn't have to sacrifice his son in the end. Where around us, we see children sacrificed sometimes by their parents all the time. Because in the Crusades, as in later events, rather than have the Crusaders kill one's family, it happened sometime, have your children taken away by the Crusaders, that parents would actually take their children's lives and then their own. So it wasn't that he never saw that happen. He did. And this just reminds you, you know, it's so disturbing, but not infrequent, that you read these things about the Jewish people in the least likely places. It happened to me this morning. I'm going for a week to Rome, so I was reading a book by Ross King called Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling about the making of the Sistine Chapel, right? Because I've been reading a bunch of stuff about Rome so that I'll be more educated when I go there. And just this morning I read that Pope Julius used to put on Jews' races. Jews' races were where everybody would gather around, dress Jews in ridiculous costumes, sometimes beat them and make them race against each other while they laughed and jeered at them. So, and now, I didn't open the book to read about Jews or Jews' races, but it is, that suffering is inescapable. And when Wiesel writes, he draws on that long history of it. One of the things that I don't know, and we'll have to find out, I talked about it on Tuesday, is it's very difficult, I'm sure. It might be almost unbearable to be a symbol to people of such an overwhelming catastrophe. And whether he will talk about the Holocaust or not, I have no idea. We didn't ask him what his topics were, and I know at least, I remember when I was a kid and I heard him speak, he spoke about something completely different. He told a very charming story about Abraham Joshua Heschel and Shaul Lieberman, who were two great scholars at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Wiesel was friendly with them both, and they both invited him the same night to be at their homes, and they lived in the same apartment building. So he told this story about getting on and off the elevator and trying to, you know, evade this one and not offend that one. And it was very, and that was his speech. It was very funny and wonderful and charming, and he didn't say a word about tragedy or destruction, and everybody loved it. But I do wonder what it is like to have people, you know, to know that when people invite you, they always associate you with that with that event. So in Abraham's life, there is not exactly that association, because in the end, Abraham is what Heschel said about himself. When Heschel used to say that he was Ud Mutzalmi Esh, which means a brand plucked from the fire. Right? It's a phrase from Jeremiah. Heschel's family, many of them were killed in the Shoah. He left, as I mentioned before, 6 weeks before the invasion of Poland and was saved. So he was plucked from the fire, as I'm sure to some extent, Wiesel must feel about himself. But I will tell you, you still have time. If you haven't read it, it's 120 pages. It will take you an hour or two, 2 hours, 3 hours maybe, to read Night. So you can find it at any bookstore, and you should read it. It's, first of all, a book that every human being should read, right? It's one of those handful of books that is essential to read. That's the one that was the Oprah's choice, right? It's in every bookstore in the world right now. It's called Night, and it's by Elie Wiesel, and you really should read it before you see him. Yeah.
The kids reading it here at Sinai.
Yes, the kids are reading it here at Sinai. Right. It's an extraordinarily powerful book. Just extraordinarily powerful.
Reading it right now.
Yeah? You said you are reading it right now?
The kids
are, yes. Right, are reading it now in preparation for his, yes. For his visit. I know.
Night.
Just called Night. I don't think he tells it in the preface to the book, although I may be wrong. He wrote a new preface. But the story of the writing of it is that for a long time after the Shoah, there wasn't much writing. I mean, Night was written, I think, in the, 55 or 56? I don't remember, which is, what year was it? 58. Okay, it was published in 58. But there's the audiobook. It was published in 58. Now that's, don't forget, 13 years after the Holocaust, which is a long time after, you know, the destruction of one-third of the world's Jews. And if you speak to people who are old enough, as happened, by the way, at Lunch and Learn, someone came up to me and said that she remembered sitting by the radio, and day after day they would hear worse and worse news. I mean, nobody knew the dimensions of the catastrophe, and every day they would liberate more camps and estimate greater numbers of Jews, until finally they estimated that 6 million people, and no one could believe it. Because we grew up knowing that was true, but it actually, to the people at the time that it happened. So Wiesel went to France. He writes his books in French. He was a journalist. And he was interviewing Francois Mauriac, who was one of the great French writers of the 20th century and an icon and a very famous figure. And Mauriac was talking about the sufferings of Christ. And Wiesel blurted out, you know, I've seen others who suffered more than Jesus ever suffered on the cross. And then he was embarrassed, because it wasn't his place to lecture this guy. And so he left. He walked away and left. And Mauriac went after him and said, you have to write about that. And so he did. And that was the origin of Night. And really, it is, he does talk about that in, I saw you nodding. Is that mentioned in the audiobook? Do you know? It isn't. Anyway, it's really worth reading. It is, it's more than worth reading. It's really essential to read. And when your children are old enough, if they're not old enough yet, it's a book you have to press into their hands and tell them that you have to read this. Because they should know. And so images like Abraham's trials and the Akedah Wiesel grew up in a world where the Torah and the Talmud and Hasidic tradition were everything. You know, there were no secular newspapers in his world. There was no television. There was no popular music. I mean, this was everything. And so when he refers to the world that he experienced, he does it in the categories that he learned from the tradition, that were implanted in him from the tradition. And so he's going to see Abraham's life that way. In fact, I'll turn just for a second to his comments on, it's called, by the way, The Sacrifice of Isaac, A Survivor's Story. Because who does a survivor identify with in the Akedah? Isaac. Isaac is the survivor, right? As a child, I read and reread this tale, my heart beating wildly. I felt dark apprehension come over me and carry me far away. There was no understanding the three characters. Why would God, the merciful Father, demand that Abraham become inhuman? And why would Abraham accept? And Isaac, why did he submit so meekly? Not having received a direct order to let himself be sacrificed, why did he consent? I want to read just one passage at the end. With it. Okay. Now remember, Yitzchak, at the very beginning, I didn't quote you, at the very beginning he says, this strange tale is about fear and faith, fear and defiance, fear and laughter. So this is how he ends it. Let us return to the question we asked at the beginning. Why was the most tragic of our ancestors named Isaac, a name which evokes and signifies laughter? Yitzchak, right? Here is why. As the first survivor, he had to teach us, the future survivors of Jewish history, that it is possible to suffer despair, to suffer and despair an entire lifetime and still not give up on the art of laughter. Isaac, of course, never freed himself from the traumatizing scenes that violated his youth. The Holocaust had marked him and continued to haunt him forever. Yet he remained capable of laughter, and in spite of everything, he did laugh. So again, it's very, the lens with which you read the text has everything to do with the life that you led. And it's a very poignant, to have him here now. Yes. Do we believe in one truth? Do we as Jews believe in one truth? The short answer is yes. If you believe in God and one God, then there's one truth. But the longer answer from my point of view, and it depends who we as Jews are, we as Jews don't believe in anything. We as Jews believe in arguing with each other about what we as Jews believe. But the issue, I think, is less whether there is one truth than whether there is one path to that one truth. That's what people argue about. And my answer to that would be no, that there isn't one path to one truth, but that there is one truth. But that one truth is great enough that it embraces all the much smaller truths that we think of as one truth. So it's infinitely great. I mean, that one truth is big enough to not have only one expression of it, one perception of it, all of those things. It's like the Midrash that when the Torah was given, all of Israel saw it as a mirror because they each saw themselves differently reflected in it. So in part, it's the meaning you give to your experience, yes, but that doesn't mean, the only reason I don't go along with that completely is it doesesn't mean that you can't be wrong, right? That suggests that there's no wrong, and I don't think, clearly Judaism doesn't believe that all meanings of experience are equally valid, right? The murderer and the murdered don't read the world equally right in the Jewish tradition, right? There is such a thing as being sinful. And there is such a thing as committing sins. And there are things that are better and things that are worse. And Anne Frank and Hitler are not on an equal plane, morally or in terms of their perception of the truth, at least according to the Jewish tradition. The idea that that meaning is fully humanly created suggests that there's no God that is greater than what we make. So, yeah. Yeah.
So as a way of understanding the Akedah, I have my own problems with it. Just an introduction of the story.
Right. Yeah, one long-time reading of the Akedah was exactly that, that the point of the Akedah was God was trying to teach Abraham, I don't do this. That he was moving Abraham away from human sacrifice to animal sacrifice. And then Maimonides said later on, God would move us from animal sacrifice to... Now, Maimonides took a lot of heat for that opinion because that suggests that the temple was not, you know, was not the best thing in the world in some ways because it was all about animal sacrifice. But Maimonides took a lot of heat for several of his opinions, although that one, he still prayed for the restoration of sacrifices when the temple came. And still, he didn't say that you shouldn't. Whereas the conservative movement, by the way, you may not know, in the Amidah of Musaf, this was a very controversial change. In an Orthodox and a traditional Amidah, you will say Na'aseh v'Nakriv. When you talk about the restoration of the temple, Na'aseh v'Nakriv is we will do and we will sacrifice. And in the conservative movement, Sidur, it says Asu v'Hikrivu, which means we did and we sacrificed. In other words, it doesn't explicitly pray for a resumption of sacrifices. So, which is a very subtle nuance. Most people obviously don't notice it or are not aware of it. But when the prayer book came out and didn't give a choice, it just said Asu v'Hikrivu. It didn't put in parentheses one or the other. So as though you could say either one, there was a big to-do about it in, you know, in the small circle of those who paid attention to what the wording was.
Going back to the sages and dreamers for a second, the passage you read about Noah,
yes,
about prologue and epilogue connecting, reminded me of the dichotomy you were talking about in the Red Sea, with that state of existence where that can incorporate with life and death.
Yep, exactly, the liminal state. You're not there and you're not here.
Yeah, and I think true of a lot of apocalyptic imagery.
I do think that's true also on this... on this morning when Da Vinci Code is being reviewed in the newspaper, we certainly shouldn't. And did you see the cover of the Jewish Journal? It has a picture of Mona Lisa with her eyes up there, and it says Code Schmode. So it's a good cover. It is a good cover. No, neither was the LA Times. Neither of them particularly liked the movie. The New York Times was less kind. At beginning, you know, the A.O. Scott's review this morning said something about the movie that was made of a book which proved that you can't, that the author couldn't write an English sentence or something like that. But, you know, that's... It was still a very entertaining book. Yeah.
After last week, I was struggling with the idea of where was Philistinia or whatever it was in the ancient days, and you were talking about it was a small nation that disappeared and this sort of thing, and right. we were looking up words, and it means the invader in Hebrew, is one of the Hebrew words, and I was thinking, we don't even know the borders of Poland in the way the European borders used to change. When my father was in the border of that shtetl, it used to be Austria, it used to be Poland, it used to be this, it used to be that, and these were nomads, and so my vision, we sort of have our vision like of nations and where they were,
I know.
The boundaries, but my...
They're very porous. That is true.
Who's the invaders and from whose point of view? What is the Crusades from the Christians and what is the Crusades from the Jews and the Muslims?
Yes.
Who are the Philistines?
That's right.
It's
true.
And who are these pesky Israelites?
These pesky Israelites.
From these other sides. So this whole notion is right in there and you get a sense of the validity when you read it.
It is certainly true that we like fixed categories in ways that history rarely obliges, you know? I mean, and lines of nations are better set now than they ever were in history, and they still change all the time. I mean, just in the past, 20 years, all sorts of nations have been created and all sorts of nations have disappeared. But yes, it is absolutely the case that everything, you know, it's Heraclitus. You can't step in the same river twice. Everything changes all the time. And when you look at a map, a map is it's a snapshot. And just like when you look at a snapshot, people look different a minute later. A map is a snapshot because things change. Even continents change. It's just that it takes longer, right? So, Yeah, I don't know when the Philistines, yes.
Can I ask a question that has nothing to do with?
Well, I don't even know what our subject is today, so. Yeah, this is a sort of Q&A wrap-up, so.
I was watching the YouTube channel last
Yes.
week, and then there was a segment about decoding the Torah. I don't know, have you ever seen that?
Bible. Yeah, I was on one of those, actually.
Yeah.
Right.
That they had decoded it, mathematician,
right.
some. That said, all the Auschwitz, Amen,
right.
healing,
right.
it had yeah. said everything. Do you believe in this?
No, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I'm not going to mince my words. I think it's absolutely ridiculous for several reasons. First of all, I can give you the site of a biblical scholar who will show you the way in which they eliminate certain letters, select certain letters, change the way letters are written, change the way Hebrew spellings are. And if you do it creatively enough, I assure you, if you give me a page of James Joyce Ulysses, I can do the same thing with it. I remember when I was in rabbinical school, and I'll be happy to give this, Jeff Teague at the University of Pennsylvania. He did a really thorough, and I have the site, I kept it on my computer every time someone asked me. When I was in rabbinical school, we had a rabbi who's well known, so I won't mention him. I won't mention his name, who gave a presentation about stuff like this. And I just, you know, first of all, I don't like the idea that faith is based on magic and tricks. That's already, I once had lunch again with a very well-known rabbi from Eshet Torah. And we were talking about the Torah codes. And I said, you know what, I think actually I have deeper faith than you. I said, because my faith isn't based on the fact that you can find that code in the Torah. And if you couldn't find that code in the Torah, I would still believe. So what kind of faith is that? That because you can manage to put together six rows of this or that or the other thing. Anyway, so this guy was talking. And he was giving us these sorts of examples from the Torah. And by the way, remember that Hebrew is a root system, which means that all the words come from three or four letter roots. So you're always going to get lots of coincidences in Hebrew. Imagine if every English word came from three letter roots. So I said to him, look, in English, live and evil are opposites of each other, L-I-V-E, E-V-I-L. He said, that's true. I said, you know why you never noticed that? Because nobody's looking. Because nobody thinks that actually live and evil will really mean anything. I said, I promise you, if somebody sits down with English, any English text, and starts to do what they're doing with the Torah, especially over thousands of years, because people have been looking, you know. In addition, I'll tell you two other things. Also, I'm not crazy about a God who encodes Hitler's name in the Torah. I mean, what kind of God is that? I'm going to secretly put Hitler's name in the Torah and Auschwitz in the Torah. I mean, the other part of it is, Larry King, before he was on television, he used to have a radio show for years and years. And when I was in college, which is, you know, now we're talking about the early 80s, the late 70s, early 80s, I used to listen to him at night when I'd go to sleep. And there was a guy who used to come on. I remember when he died, they did an obituary for him on the National Public Radio. He was called the Numbers Man. And the Numbers Man, it turns out, go figure, was born Jewish. But he had become obsessed by the numbers of revelations in the New Testament. And he would call up and he would give King incredible coincidence with everything that was going on in the world, right? All sorts of number correlations and so on and so forth. And King would always let him speak for a couple minutes because he was an interesting guy, even though he was a bit of a nut. And then at the end, King would always ask him the same question. He would say, tell me what's going to happen tomorrow. If it's really all in there, don't tell me what you found about what happened yesterday. Tell me what's going to happen tomorrow, and then I'll believe you. And of course, that can never happen. If you want me to find the name of some concentration camp in Messengers of God, I'll go through the book and I will bet you anything that I will find it in code. And the more time I spend, especially if it's a language like Hebrew. Better yet, give me a modern Hebrew novel, and I'll find it easily. But until they find who's going to win the next election, I'm not impressed. Yeah. Don?
Writing the source of the writing. Sure, you know,
Oh, we've talked about it a couple of times. So I'm going to, and I would be happy to do it, but we don't have enough time to do it comprehensively. So if you save it, I'll be happy to do another class on it, maybe at the beginning of next year, about the authorship of the Torah. However, if you what you hold up, which is the Eitz Chaim, has articles about it that more or less reflect the kinds of things that I said at the beginning of the class. I don't know if that class is on tape or not, but I'm happy to do it again about how the Torah came to be from a modern perspective. Let's put it that way. So what else? Anything else? Yes. Right, the same idea. Yeah, I talked about the fact that when we discovered not so much Greek books, but other ancient Near Eastern texts, that they had a lot of parallels to stories in the Torah, some differences, some significant differences. We talked about them with Noah. But part of it also is the vast majority of ancient writings are lost. I mean, maybe there was another similar story about an Abraham. We don't know, because how many Sumerian writings do we have compared to how many there were? So, you know, we have I don't know, 10 plays of Aeschylus, one of the great Greek tragedians. We know, though, that the Library of Alexandria had a complete set of his plays, which were 140 or 150 plays, and when it burned down, that was it. They were lost forever. Just imagine, when we talk about ancient parallels to the Torah, the answer is we have ancient parallels, but they're only the ones we know about. So it's very hard to figure what else may have been out there. The Torah, like every book, was born in a context, and people told similar stories through different traditions. The way you know what the Torah's values are is how the Torah emphasizes its stories. So, for example, there's a flood story in the Gilgamesh tale. The difference is that the reason the gods bring a flood is because human beings are annoying the gods. They're pestering them. In other words, there's no moral to the tale. It's just the gods get annoyed. In Noah's time, it's not because God gets annoyed. It's because people are immoral to each other. So that's where you look for, it's not that there aren't parallels to the stories. It's what the stories mean in the Torah as opposed to what they mean other places. By the way, the whole Gilgamesh story is about finding immortality, which also is not so dissimilar. And when he grabs an immortality plant and at the end of his quest, you know what steals it away from him? A water snake. Clear parallels to Eden in lots of ways. So, you know, nobody's born in a vacuum. No people, no individual. Everybody's born in a context. And Israelites, of course, heard the stories of all the traditions around them in developing their own traditions too. So, but that's not a bad thing. It's only a bad thing when people don't know it. I remember when I was, I did a panel years ago in San Luis Obispo for Cal Poly. It was a priest, an Islamic scholar, and I were all speaking about our traditions. And the Islamic scholar was handing out this sheet to show the values of Islam, and the first was a quote from the Quran that said, "He who destroys a single life, it's as if he destroys an entire world, and he who saves a single life, it's as if he saves an entire world." So, because there were only a few Jewish students, and most of the students there were not Jewish, and they had brought me up there basically because they didn't want to be alone. So I held that up and I said how beautiful that was. I said it's so beautiful, in fact, that 400 years before it was written in the Quran, it was written in the Mishnah. In almost exactly these words. Now, according to fundamentalist Islamists, Islam didn't take anything from anyone. It was all a direct revelation from God. But that's very similar in some ways to what an ancient Sumerian might say about the Torah. He might say, hey, we have some of these stories too, to which we would say, yeah, but the stories aren't relevant that you had them. This is our direct revelation from God. And it's just a coincidence that, you know, as he said to me, that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi said it in the year 200 was just a coincidence, even though Muhammad hadn't been born yet, and the same thing here. But I would say this. The fact, to me, it's a wonderful thing that the fact that someone like Wiesel, who is deeply, deeply rooted in the Jewish tradition, who's extraordinarily learned, who speaks Yiddish and speaks Hebrew fluently, and for that matter, several other languages, still writes in French. That's not a bad thing. Right? It's not a bad thing to acknowledge that Judaism can be enriched by the traditions of the world, just as Judaism can enrich the traditions of the world. And I would say it was always true. So, yes. Yeah. Yeah, he does. I mean, he does. And I think that his the way I defined it on Tuesday is, you know, Robert Frost said that he had a lover's quarrel with the world. And that seems to be Wiesel's. He said many times that a Jew can love God or hate God, but cannot be indifferent to God. And I think that his expression of that was how he felt at the moment, but it's clear that he's God-haunted throughout his whole life. I don't think he regained his faith. I think that he never lost his struggle. And that's, you know, and that passage where he sees the God on the gallows, when the child is on the gallows, he told me once that that was actually a direct borrowing from Rashi. Rashi, when it says in the Torah that you're not allowed to leave if you hang someone, you can't leave the corpse there overnight because, and Rashi says that's because the corpse is an image of God, right? It's still an image of God there, even though it's not alive. And so when he wrote that, that was what was in his mind, was that child was just like Rashi said, was an image of God. Now, the problem is he was so saturated in this that he assumed when, not assumed when he wrote it, but that when he wrote it and when he said it, that was part of his language. I mean, everybody would know. It's like if I say Da Vinci Code, everybody would know what it is. But of course, we don't know what it is. So even there, even in what's taken as his most radical expression of separation from God, it's in fact, it comes out of Rashi, for God's sakes. So it's a very different, it's a very different way of being. He grew up in a different world. You know, Sigut, from Sigut to Los Angeles is quite a journey. It's not the same world. Yeah. The problem with the summer session, thank you, but the problem with the summer session is I'm gone, other people are gone. It's so spotty that we don't get, you know. So I would just say the classes are on tape. The sermons are still every week, and they're online. And the Torah is still here, but thank you. I really appreciate that. Have a good summer. I hope to see you this weekend.